Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to a bonus episode of the TLS podcast. I'm Toby Lischtig, the fiction editor of the TLS, and I'm joined today by Bernardine Evaristo, who earlier this week won the Booker Prize in conjunction with Margaret Atwood for her novel Girl, Woman, Other, a polyphonic, multi-generational collage of the lives of 12 characters, mostly black women. We've already discussed the controversy over the awarding of a double Booker on this week's podcast, and I'm delighted not to have to revisit that now, and instead to welcome Bernardine to the studio and to talk about what really matters, her book. So welcome, Bernardine.
Hi, it's great to be here.
I guess it's been quite a frenetic couple of days for you.
Understatement. As soon as the announcement was made, we were whisked off to a press conference, and then we had lots of press interviews, and then it continued early the next morning, and I didn't get home till about 10 o'clock last night, and up again this morning, but it's all good.
Hooray.
Yes.
When I was at the ceremony on Monday night, Anna Burns, who was last year's winner for Milkman, gave quite a moving speech, I thought, about what winning the Booker had done for her career, for her finances, obviously, the sort of the literary recognition and the frenetic last year she's had. Apart from the money, obviously, what does it mean for you and what will it do for you, do you think?
What it means for me is it's given my work incredible exposure internationally, because this prize is so important. And that's what I've always wanted for my writing. And yet I've really never reached large audiences at all. So I've written 8 books, but most people haven't read them. And they come across them and then they say, oh, I really like your work. Have you, you know, what else have you written? And this, you know, then they're curious about what else I've written and they gen up on me and so on. So I feel that a lot of the work of making my books known has now been done in terms of this prize, and I'll feel the ripple effect of this for quite a while. As I said in my acceptance speech, I am the first black woman to win it, and the first black British person to win it. So I think it's historic and significant that this prize has gone to somebody like me, writing the kind of book that I have, which is all about black British women. So I think the impact on black women, actually, and perhaps, you know, women of colour and marginalised people and black people in this country and perhaps in other places will be huge. I've already experienced a lot of people being very emotional about me winning this prize. People I know, people in my writing community, people on social media saying they were in tears, they were bawling, they couldn't believe it because I'm a black woman. And I think also because I am 60 and I've been in this game for nearly 40 years, it's a sign for me that you can just plow ahead decade after decade and then come away with a bit of a gift, you know?
Is it a chance for you to revisit your backlist a bit? Because I guess they're going to be translations, not just of this book, but some of your previous books that haven't previously been translated. And maybe it's a chance to think about some of the novels you've written earlier in your career that perhaps you haven't thought about for a while.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, the translation rights are coming in thick and fast, which is what I've always wanted. And I can't quite believe it. Every day there's sort of like Lithuania, you know, Korea, Georgia. This is just incredible. But I'm already very familiar with my backlist. I've always been doing lots of readings. So I'm very much out there as a writer. And I have been reading from my books, for a long time. So I'm not distanced from my backlist, I would say.
Right, right.
Yeah.
To the novel itself, yes. Girl, Woman, Other. So you've got these 12 characters spanning the generations. I guess this is a novel less about Black British experience than the multifariousness of Black British experience, which is the whole point. Is that something you think has been missing from British fiction, or is it more the recognition of that has been missing? You know, are there lots of other of these voices out there that aren't being recognised, or do you feel like it's not been done enough?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that it has been missing from British fiction, and we know that and have felt that. But it doesn't seem to have got out there. Do you know what I mean? Like the publishing industry for a long time thought it was all right to just publish less than a handful of Black British women writers, of which I have been one, and ignore the fact that, I don't even know what the statistics are, but ignore the fact that we were writing from very limited perspectives because there were so few of us. I'm hoping that this will change now, you know, because if you win the Booker Prize, it kind of sets a precedent, and hopefully publishers will be inspired to sort of diversify their lists a bit more. I was talking to Candice Carty-Williams, who's published her first novel, Queenie, this year, and we were trying to work out how many books by and about Black British women have been published this year. And we came to the conclusion there were two. We may be wrong, but we couldn't think of anybody else.
And this doesn't seem like a particularly peculiar year either, presumably.
This is a good year, right? I'm talking about adult books.
Yeah.
There are a couple of books coming out by Black British women writers, but they're not necessarily about Black British women. So there you go. There are the statistics. How many novels are published every year? Do you know?
I don't know, but it's definitely thousands.
Thousands.
So, yeah.
So we think there's two of us.
Okay.
I've written 12.
You've written 12. So hopefully this is the floodgates opening.
Maybe.
Talking of what you're saying, there's a line in your book when one of the characters says, Black people feel the burden of representation, whereas white people only have to represent themselves. And I just wondered if you could talk a little bit about that burden for yourself, and to what extent it's been a burden, and to what extent it has possibly freed you to write as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the characters' point of view.
Yeah.
It's not my point
nope,
of view, actually.
I accept that.
It is the point of view of many writers. They don't want to have to represent whatever sort of demographic they're supposed to represent. But I don't see it as a burden. You know, I've had a differing relationship, or, you know, varied relationships to the idea of being a Black writer over the course of my career. And there was a stage when I was just fed up of it and I thought, you know, don't call me a Black writer, I'm just a writer. But actually, I'm at a stage now where I just own it. That is the perspective from which I write. That doesn't mean to say I'm only writing Black British characters, because I don't. You know, I've written various stories, but I'm very interested in the African diaspora from a British perspective. And that's what I do. That's what I write. I remember Toni Morrison years ago saying, I'm an African-American writer. That's what I am. I write African-American stories. I'm not ashamed of it. That's how I feel. And there is no limitation to that.
Earlier stories, you've set a story in ancient Rome. You've set a story, you know, sort of reversing the sort of the binaries of slavery, but it's still about Black British experience.
Yes, and the story set in Roman London, in fact, is about a Black British girl growing up in Roman London. So there is no limitation to that, because take, you know, one of our most celebrated writers, Ian McEwan. He might not say, when he's talking to you in a podcast, you know, I only write about white men.
Because he doesn't have to, because he doesn't. There's less of that burden.
But he doesn't only do that. That's a bit unfair. But I mean, he writes from that perspective,
absolutely.
And that's what he writes, and everybody just accepts that.
Yep.
Whereas I'm making a point of telling you this is what I'm doing, and people are noticing that this is what I'm doing. So I'm kind of... there's an activism about it as well, you know, and it's a good thing, and it's a positive thing, and it's as limitless as anybody writing about any demographic.
And of course, it's not a sole demographic. One of your points, so we talked about multifariousness, but there are subgroups in it. So you've got your character, Amma, who spent some of her life in a lesbian collective in the 1980s, the Republic of Freedomia, I think is that what it's called?
Squat.
Then you've got the character Bumi, who insists that her daughter Carol marries a Nigerian man, and Carol doesn't want to do this. You've got Carol herself, who gets into Oxford and then has to deal with the ludicrous cliqueiness of that place. And there's a very funny line when she's sort of trying to get to grips with the mores, and she talks about how omelettes are not classy, but Spanish omelettes are classy, even though they seem to be made from the same things. I was interested in the extent to which this is actually a book about class as well, and the sort of different subgroups within classes in this country, which is still sort of riven by class.
It is. It's a book about many things, I think, because about the intersection of race and class and gender and sexuality. And I think I didn't intend to to sort of sew class through it, but it became inevitable in a sense because I was interested in looking at where people start and where they end up and the journey they take to get there. So I do that with all of the women. You kind of know where they are now in the 21st century. The book spans 100 years, but then you also find out how they got to their position now, whether they're 19 or 93, because the oldest character is 93 and there's every generation in between. And when you start to look at people's journey through life and when you're looking at how we succeed in this society, which is something else that I was looking at, I think class is factored into that. So there are characters who are born in one class, which is really basically working class or even immigrant class, who then progress to middle class, you know, from sort of unskilled labour to being professional in whether it's the corporate world or banking or theatre or working in education. We know that we're a class obsessed society, and it's something that we tend not to describe in terms of our black populations. You know, people often talk about the working class and they don't somehow think they're including people of colour.
Yeah, it often,
most of whom are working class, actually.
Often the word white is attached to working class. You hear a lot about the white working class,
yes.
But it's absolutely true.
And it's ridiculous. And also, I come from a working class family. Working class can be variously described, but my mother was a school teacher, but my father was an immigrant, Nigerian. He was a welder. I'm now a Booker-winning writer and a professor, you know, and you know, listen to how I speak. You know, you would not think necessarily that I come from the class that I come from, but I do. And that's been a very long journey. And at some point in my life, I know when it was, when I was 14, I changed the way I spoke in order to kind of assimilate better.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
And to what extent is your book then a celebration of that fluidity, and to what extent are your characters hidebound? Because there's one moment when it's Amma's mother says of her father, who's this essentially well-meaning, I would say, but quite patriarchal character, a Ghanaian man, and she says he's of his time and culture. So there's a sense that he is somehow stuck in what made him. To what extent is that true of the characters in your book more generally and the Britain that you see and describe?
That they're stuck, they're sort of unable to move beyond their situation.
Yeah.
I think all my characters move beyond their situation. Yeah. You know, and that's not necessarily what I was thinking of when I wrote it. But they're all, no, as I said, they're all on some kind of journey to improve their lives. And I like to put a positive spin on things. I'm not a bleak writer. I want my work to have, to celebrate, not to dismiss the struggles, but also to sort of balance that with celebration and for there to be hope embedded in it. And
there's a very hopeful ending. We won't give it away, obviously.
It's a very hopeful ending. Yeah. I was not going to write a novel about 12 primarily black British women and end it on a bleak note, because we know that our society at the moment feels quite bleak anyway. I wanted my women, even though when sometimes they are victims of circumstance, I want them to rise above that and to be triumphant in whatever little way is relevant to the situation that they're in. So sometimes difficult things happen to them. Sometimes bad things happen to them. Sometimes they do spend years struggling, but they are not defeated by that. And that's kind of, you know, I kind of want to inspire with that. So these women are, they're works of the imagination. They come out of my imagination, but they're also the product, in a way, of everybody I've ever met, everybody I've ever spoken to, all the black women I've known, all the generations of black women that I've known. And I'm kind of like, I've kind of absorbed who they are. And through osmosis, I'm kind of like then recreating them in the novel. And I want people to see themselves in it. And that's one of the things the black women readers say. This is a book where we see ourselves, because there are so many of them as well. And it's not that they necessarily fully identify with any single character, but because it's written from a black woman's perspective in this country, there are so many things that people go, oh yeah, yeah, I've been there, blah, blah, blah. So to me, it's kind of, it's showing us the possibilities of who we can be in a positive way.
And actually, I must say, reading it as a white man, I found it, firstly, incredibly refreshing to be given that multiplicity of perspectives from something that's very different from my own experience. But also, you seem to completely nail the universal, because there's nothing that seems difficult to understand or inaccessible or anything like that. And I guess that's sort of the gold standard of this sort of writing, that you're giving voice to a particular narrative experience, but allowing readers to, any reader, to engage with it.
Yeah, that's interesting that sort of white middle-class men are liking my book.
Yeah.
You know, because I mean, I wasn't thinking of a readership, to be honest, but I was thinking, I do want black women to know that this is a book about them. But then when you put a book out there in the world, you don't know who's going to read it. But if it does have a universality to it, and that only comes through the specifics, right, of character and writing with integrity and making sure your characters are interesting and rich and flawed and all those things, then that's fantastic.
And voice, I think, voice is really important for this one. So, in fact, for listeners who haven't read the novel and don't really know sort of how it's structured or whatever, you've got these 12 characters. They're essentially each quartered a chapter, aren't they? And it's loosely structured around this theatrical performance. So some are involved in it in some way, some attend an after party, some sort of read about it. The way you've written it, I mean, it's essentially a series of single sentence paragraphs without full stops, which seems to me a really brilliant way of dealing with the kind of the close third person. So you rove in and out of these characters' thoughts with this voice that constantly changes, and the diction changes, and the lexicon changes. And I thought that was done really, really brilliantly. And I just wondered, sort of, how did that evolve, and what other writers did you draw inspiration on for that kind of technique?
Yeah, I wouldn't say it was their single sentence paragraphs, because I think that might put people off.
Oh, sorry, yes.
Because the shape on the pages are sort of, well, I call it, this may sound a bit pretentious, but I call it a pro-poetic patterning.
Yep.
In that it's not poetry, but it's a bit like poetry, but the writing flows on the page and there aren't that many full stops, but there are lots of commas, and the spaces in between the text gives you breathing space. So that form, I actually used it in my previous book, Mr. Loverman, where I had the main character, Barrington, who's a gay 74-year-old man, telling his story in the first person, and I needed to find a device to tell for his wife to tell her story that would not compete with his voice. And they're both from Antigua and they're both the same age. So I found a sort of form, which was the form that I guess I use in Girl, Woman, Other, which is the same kind of thing on the page, kind of quite poetic. I also told her voice in the second person also to distinguish between his. But with this book, I found it was a very free-flowing writing experience. And I hope it's a free-flowing reading experience.
It is. It really is.
So once you're in it, you're into the rhythm of it, the rhythm of the language. And don't forget, I did begin as a poet, so I'm always paying very special attention to the way in which I'm using language. Once you're in it, you're inside the women's heads, even though, and you're hearing their voices, even though it's in the third person, as you say. And then I'm going back into the past, I'm coming up to the future. There's interiority, there's exteriority, and you're kind of floating along their subconscious. And then you float into another character's head, and the same things happen, but they're very different. And that's kind of has a cumulative effect until in the end of it, you've just been inside the heads of these 12 women. And hopefully had something of an experience.
You have.
And aren't too traumatised by us.
Definitely not traumatised. And so, yeah, you talk about having worked as a poet. I mean, you've written a verse novel before. You've also worked in the theatre. And there's a kind of, you've got this construct of this theatre performance and the polyphonous nature of, I guess, this book, there's a kind of theatricality to that, and yes. Form and theme and style seem to kind of meld quite well. Do you still work in theatre?
No, I don't. But I'd like to go back to writing for theatre, because I miss that world, and I'd love to have work on the stage again. I left writing for theatre really properly about 30-something years ago. But yeah, I like to inhabit my characters. So when I'm writing them, I feel like I'm inside them. And that's what we do as actors, or what I used to do as actors. Do you know what I mean? You become your characters as much as you can. You know, you try to experience their thoughts and their feelings and their lives. And I think that comes through with my work, because there is a performative element to my work. You know, people say it's very lively, very vibrant.
I can completely see this being staged in some way. I presume there's an audiobook on the way if there isn't one already.
There is one at the moment.
There is, but I mean, I must go and listen to that, because I imagine it would work extremely well in that format.
Yes, so the characters do come alive. And I think that is to do with my theatrical background. You know, not all writers are particularly interested in writing the kinds of very lively, leap off the page characters that I do. They may be more plot driven, or the voice may be quieter, whereas I'm quite a bold, daring, kind of risk taking writer in terms of the way in which I create characters.
What you don't have is the sort of, and I use hectoring cautiously because it can be a good thing as well, but you don't have this sort of hectoring single narrative voice that says, I am the narrator and this is my world. Instead, you've got this kind of melange.
And the characters are, you know, I like to put humour into my work, although I have to say it does happen naturally, but I'm not reverent towards my characters.
Yeah.
So I think sometimes people hear about this book and they think, oh, it's a very serious book about the tragedy of being a black British woman.
I found it brilliantly irreverent. So, for example, you've got the Carol character who is this... She works in the city, and there's a kind of gently ribbing element to the opening paragraphs about her, that she's sort of part of this world, and you know, whether or not you like that world, you can sort of see the flaws in it. And then we're suddenly taken back to a very traumatic incident when she's much younger, and it's, you know, nothing as crude as it's explained to you how she gets to this world, but you suddenly, from going from this sort of slightly distant, gently mocking device, you're suddenly with her and empathising with her. And I think that works very well throughout the novel, yeah. Sort of the kind of the zoom in and zoom out.
That's right. But also I'm quite critical. Do you know what I mean? I don't write my characters uncritically. And also, we see each character through other people. So there's four mothers and daughters. So we see the mothers through the daughters and the daughters through the mothers. And that's quite fertile territory, I would say, for humour. yes. And also, the characters are quite contradictory, or shall we say hypocritical in some ways. So you have Amma, the radical lesbian feminist who feels that she's very principled. But actually, she was spotted in the Cereal Lovers Cafe, which is a cafe selling 200 kinds of breakfast cereal, by her daughter. So it's like, you know, characters cut through the BS in terms of seeing...
The daughter calls her a feminazi at one point.
She calls her a feminazi, you know. So that's... I really enjoy that, because I think that makes them human, because that's who we are. You know, I have been known to read Hello magazine. People might think that I spend my evenings reading the TLS, because I'm a professor.
And writing for the TLS, we should say.
Yes, and I do write for the TLS as well, but, you know... I love styling Hollywood. It's great, you know. So we're made up of many different... We have many different aspects to ourselves.
We talked a bit about hope and the hopefulness of the novel. To what extent is that a reaction for you about things that are going on now? And there was a TLS piece you wrote. You reviewed René Adé-Lodge's Why I'm No Longer Talking to White People About Race. And you say in that, in Britain, we are taught not to see race. And I wondered whether you feel that's changing at all, or whether you feel actually we're going backwards on that particular point. And then more generally, you know, as I say, whether the hope in this novel is somehow a kind of way of kicking
against... I think
the
hope is just me.
It's just you.
Well, I hoped I'd win the Booker, and then I did.
And you did.
I do think race is not part, generally speaking, unless something dramatic happens, usually traumatic. Race is not part of the national conversation in this country. When I go to America, it is part of the conversation. You know, I very rarely have discussions about race in the UK that are not generated by me.
And you know? Obviously you think it should be more part of the conversation.
I think it should, because it's something that we are living in a society where race is an issue. And, you know, if you look at the disproportionate number of young black men who are incarcerated, or who are, you know, sectioned under the Mental Health Act, if you look at employment, if you look at the fact that I'm one of 26 black women professors in this country out of 17,000 professors.
Well, the two novels about black female British experience were never published this year.
Absolutely. So clearly there's a problem. But it's always up to the people of colour to kind of generate the conversation and to try to sort of instigate change and so on. And I just don't think we've really found, as a nation, we've really found the way to tackle issues around race, but also other forms of inequality that helps people bring those ideas on board without becoming defensive or dismissive. Because still today, I know people who will talk about racist incidents or being the sort of, I don't want to use the word victim, but victim of kind of microaggressions and so on. And people say, oh, no, that didn't happen. Nobody's racist, of course. Even the word racist is a difficult word because nobody is racist. Nobody wants to be seen as racist. Like men, how many men are sexist will admit that they're sexist. So these words kind of provoke a defensive mechanism that shuts down the doors. So how do we have this conversation? So you talk about unconscious bias. That's a kind of softer way of approaching the sort of different ways in which people treat people who are not like them differently. But then sometimes it's not unconscious, it is just bias. So it's a difficult subject.
Well, hopefully this book, winning the Booker Prize, will in some way prove a bit of a corrective to that situation.
Maybe. Help it a bit.
Help it a bit.
Yes.
And on that, I guess we should end there. But thank you so much for coming to talk to me.
Thank you very much.